Welcome, warrior. You are listening to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Assault Group Book Review Podcast. Your hosts, Jorn Vestai Vampyr and Jajim Tai Jajim, will explore Klingon culture as it appears in Star Trek literature. Perhaps you yourself can hear the cry of your inner warrior. If so, go to www.kag.org and make your presence known. Learn how to join the Klingon Assault Group and begin your journey along the way of the warrior. Now, here are your hosts, Kapla. Welcome to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Book Review Podcast. My name is Jajim.
And I am Jorn.
And today we're going to be looking at Forged in Fire by Michael A. Martin and Andy Mangelis.
This was supposed to be a series of Star Trek books based on Excelsior, the USS Excelsior, with Captain Sulu in command. But as far as I can tell, this was the only book of the series that ever got written.
Oh, no kidding. I didn't look for that.
Well, the way they've got this book written and the way they've got it wrapped up, it's a fairly good standalone novel. It wraps up some things. It places us in a timeline that we can understand some of the details that are going to come at us in Star Trek DS9 when they launch the Blood Oath episode.
Yeah, there is quite a bit of that. Why don't you give us a brief summary of the plot, John, and then we'll launch into the rest of this.
Well, if you look at the back of the book, it's an untold tale of Star Trek history revealed at last. Or aren't we glad they finally were? Never mind. A vicious pirate known as the Albino is cutting a deadly swath through space, creating turmoil in the Klingon Empire that threatens to spill into the Federation. But this criminal also has a secret that could shake the halls of Imperial power, and his genocidal plans against the race that bore him will have consequences even he cannot imagine, as several unlikely allies join swords to bring the Albino to justice. Sulu of the USS Excelsior, Klingon Captains Kor, Koloth, and Kang, and a hot-headed young Federation diplomat named Curzon Dax, tempered in the flames of their shared adversity, a captaincy is formed, a blood oath is sworn, and a hunt begins that will stretch from one generation to the next.
That sounds pretty epic.
Yeah, that it does.
Well, you know what? I read this book rather quickly. It was really engaging. It was a lot of fun to read. Everybody was very familiar. We got some background on familiar characters that that fleshed them out even more. And I thoroughly enjoyed this book.
It was nice that while at the beginning of the book, Sulu is brought in as the executive officer, the number one of the Excelsior, and Stiles from Star Trek III, The Search for Spock, is still the captain of the ship. But as we go through the story, we find that other members of the Enterprise that we are familiar with are brought on board.
Yeah, so Sulu is the first officer, and Stiles doesn't seem to have changed a bit from the character in the movie. He's pretty arrogant, and doesn't take very long before he makes up his mind he's not a big fan of his first officer.
I think the situation there is Stiles actually has changed. He's anti anybody from the Enterprise.
Yeah. He does seem to have an axe to grind with Sulu, but so doesn't he should have some say in who his first officer is, so why would he choose Sulu?
I got that he didn't choose Sulu, that Sulu was assigned to him. I think he was trying to lean towards Cutler, who was already a higher up officer, but not the first officer, who had just left the ship.
Okay. Cutler was not very friendly towards Sulu either. and they kind of.
She was very friendly to Styles.
Oh yeah. Well, they'd probably been working together for a very long time, but Styles.
That explains why she was not fond of Sulu, because Styles wasn't.
Yeah, which in the book, it does say that it goes all the way back to Kirk making Styles look like a fool. Well, actually, not Kirk. He blames it on Kirk. He blames it on the Enterprise, but it was Scotty who messed up their transwarp drive and kind of made them look a little stupid by leaving them in the dust.
You know, you mentioned that you say it was a while ago, but I think according to the book, it was only like 3 to 4 years prior to the events of this book, which brings me to the fact that there's a lot of timelines being illuminated in this book, and some of them didn't really make sense to me.
Ah, well, it is rich. It's very rich in a lot of Star Trek lore, and it does move around a lot.
Well, let me give you another example. When we first meet him, Captain Koloth has just encountered the Enterprise and has had an extremely large tribble sent over to his engine room, where one of his officers decides to take care of the problem by using a disruptor on the tribble, which breaks it down into thousands of smaller tribbles now flooding their engine room, which is the ending for one of the Star Trek animated series episodes.
I think that one was called More Troubles, More Tribbles, or something like that.
Something like that, yeah. It's just, if that was the case, it almost puts that episode between Star Trek, at least between Star Trek 1 and Star Trek 2, the movies.
Yeah, that sounds about right. That was kind of funny in a way, but Koloth sure didn't think it was very funny to get another shipment of tribbles from the Enterprise.
Yeah, but my point is, I thought the animated series was supposed to be fleshing out the 5-year mission that in the series only went 3 years, and then the movies took over after the 5-year mission was over.
Oh, yeah, I think so.
So the Koloth incident with the large tribble and the glomer that wouldn't do anything about it should have happened years before the events of this book.
Yeah, that's very true. In any case, well, it does happen. And well, yeah, you're right, because it seems like in the Deep Space Nine episode where Kor, Koloth, and Kang have their ridges back, That happens right towards the end of this book. So, yeah, it does seem like the timelines are kind of close together. The authors took some liberties with timelines.
Not necessarily on that particular thing, Jim. If you went to the dates that the authors were putting in the books, there was a good 60-plus years that took place between the end of the events of the book and the second epilogue that they had, where Kang is getting really, really close to tracking down the albino, which are the events that led up to Blood Oath and DS9.
Oh, yeah, that's right, too. Huh. So there were some huge liberties taken with timelines in this book.
Some explained, some maybe not so explained. But yeah, it gets confusing if you're not paying really, really, really close attention to where events are happening. It's like watching the Marvel movies, and you have to realize that the first one, Iron Man, does not take place before the first Captain America movie. You got to switch them around in your mind to get the order right.
Yeah, there's a couple of them that are kind of like that. So at any rate, we've talked a little bit about Sulu and Styles, and we also encounter Lieutenant Commander Rand aboard the Enterprise. She seems to be, what, third officer? At least she's...
third officer in charge of communications.
And she has a prominent role here. She's seems to be kind of refereeing between Cutler and Sulu when Sulu finally does take command after Styles is killed.
Hey, it's thanks to Rand that Sulu can get his message to Starfleet, and more importantly, Sarak, so that they can go and guard the conference.
Yeah. And that conference, that was quite a barn burner in itself, wasn't it?
But I name dropped there. Another character we see being brought into this is Ambassador Sarak.
Yeah, Sarak, well, you would expect him to be there in any case, representing the Federation.
Is he the only ambassador they have?
So it would seem, because he's got his fingers
looking at the movies, looking at the series. Yeah.
Yeah. Only this time he has a young Curzon Dax along with him to help out, part of his staff, actually.
And it's nice that they do a juxtaposition of assignments, because Sarak is just coming off a diplomatic mission where patience and understanding and waiting for things to happen is the name of the game for the race he's dealing with, which is totally the opposite of what's needed with the Klingons, and Curzon can see this.
Curzon is definitely far more passionate, at least behaves more passionately than Sarak does, and that would be a good thing to have along when you are negotiating with Klingons. You need someone that's passionate, someone who can stand up to them, understand Klingon logic, and apply it, whereas Sarak would probably, I'm sure he would do just fine, but I think it would, I don't think he would get the message across as forcefully as Curzon would.
I think we also need to understand, too, in this novel, Curzon Dax, that we saw at the beginning of Deep Space Nine, as the old man who's dying of natural causes that gives the symbiote over to Jadzia. In this book, he is as young as Jadzia was at the beginning of DS9. So you're looking at a young man here versus Ambassador Sarak, who is he's well into his hundreds, isn't he?
Yes, he would be.
So just their longevity gives them the difference in perspective.
Well, of course, yes. But then again, Curzon has the symbionts previous hosts, which would be, I think there would be 5 or 6 previous hosts to draw upon, which he does several times throughout the book.
But he draws on them for technical knowledge. I have the feeling that it is the Curzon symbiote that studied the Klingons enough to know what he needed to do to earn their respect, for him to earn his honor.
Yes, he did. Well, he did very well doing that. He knew the Klingons. He knew how to deal with them. And, I mean, you're not going to get 3 tougher Klingons to deal with than Kang, Kor, and Koloth. And he certainly endeared himself to those 3. They were a little skeptical at first. You know, they were looking for someone that was an equal, and they didn't look at Curzon as an equal for quite some time. But over and over again, Curzon managed to prove himself to those 3.
And what's nice is that Curzon was never sure that what he was doing was right. He was, if you look in the dialogue to himself, he was always questioning what he was doing, as if maybe what he's doing is not going to achieve what he wants to.
And let's talk about Kang, Kor, and Koloth themselves. I felt like they were spot on in this book, the way they interacted with each other, the way they behaved, their speech, everything. I just thought was very, very spot on.
As opposed to what we saw in Pawns and Shadows?
Most definitely.
Interestingly enough, the authors acknowledge Pawns and Shadows in the back of the book.
Yes, they do. But I could actually visualize the actors that played these 3 guys in my mind as I read.
And what I think is important here, too, is the first time we see Koloth is in The Trouble with Tribbles. And he is a jolly, carefree Klingon in that particular episode. When we see him in Blood Oath, he's a brooding, stands in the back, determined Klingon warrior. And this book kind of takes that character from the initial scene where the Tribble explodes to the end of the book and shows his progression to a more serious Klingon.
Oh, yes. It answers a lot of questions, this book does, and that's one of the particular ones on Koloth. We still do see Koloth's sense of humor, though, whenever he interacts with Kor, because Koloth loves nothing better than pushing Kor's buttons.
Yeah.
I look forward to those two interacting, and I would have liked to have even seen more.
I don't remember how much of it you saw in Blood Oath, but I don't think there was a lot. It was mostly between Kang and Kor.
Yeah, quite a bit. But no, there was some of those little interactions between Kor and Koloth in the episode too. They were subtle. They were a little more subtle, but you could see the tension between them. I think that's kind of what the authors drew on and expanded on a little bit in this book.
Which I think is what makes this tale, this book, much better, in that it does flesh these characters out that we've just seen superficially in a couple of hours.
I would love to see this book made into a movie. I think it would make a heck of a good movie.
I think George is getting a little bit too old for this, though. And all the Klingons are dead.
Yeah, that's the unfortunate part. I don't think I would want to see the three of them done with CGI. I don't think that would work. And none of the three of those guys, I mean, Michael and Sarah, William Campbell, and John Colicos, I don't think anybody but those guys could do this part. Of course, I've thought the same thing about other things and seen other actors come in, but I don't think I would want to see anybody but those three on screen.
Well, it's like the fact that Spock has now been played by two other actors, and I really can't say that either one of those two actors is doing a bad job with the character.
No, I would agree. I completely agree. It's just hard to imagine. I mean, well, look at Battlestar Galactica. They not only had a different actor for Starbuck, but they gender bent him into a female, and she was amazing.
Of course, they did change the entire story.
Oh yeah, expanded on it a whole lot. So at any rate, let's talk a little bit about Kag, the albino. The villain in this thing.
The penguin of the story.
Penguin? I'll tell you.
He was like the penguin of Batman. He was discarded at birth for physical deformities.
Okay.
Collected up by non-Klingons and nurtured to adulthood and a career.
And he really, really was a nasty, nasty little person, wasn't he?
The only question I would have is, where did he get his education? Because he was, you know, I want to say almost a savant in microbiology.
Yeah, so it would seem. And we don't see a lot of his background. We see him getting collected up, saved from freezing to death, basically, and then he's grown up. We don't get a whole lot in between there.
No, we don't. But if another thought occurred to me too is all of the stuff that he works with, all the viruses that he deals with, are ones that we've seen in the Star Trek stories.
Yeah, only he tends to make them even worse and actually manipulates these viruses and these things that he uses to fit just particular people or particular species or different things like that. And that's
they won't activate until they recognize the genome that they're put into.
Yeah, that's really scary.
But what's interesting is because they're using some of the viruses that we know about, say the omega-4 virus, Sulu, who's been exposed to the omega-4 virus and cured of the virus, is immune to what the albino tries to do to him.
Now, the omega-4 virus was the one that we saw in the original series episode, Omega Glory, right? Where we get Kirk
yes.
beaming down to the planet, and that's the patriotic episode of the original series.
Correct.
Okay.
But the Leviathan flu, and I'm butchering that name, comes from Enterprise. When they initially had to use it to, A, bring the augment genes into the Klingon genome, and B, cure the Klingons of the augment genes they had brought into the genome, which gave everybody the smooth foreheads and the human-like look.
Very much to the chagrin of everybody, because we have two factions or two types of Klingons referred to in the book. We've got the Kuch-Ha and the Hemkuch. The Kuch-Ha being the smooth forehead ones, is that right?
Correct.
Okay, and then the Hemkuch with the ridged foreheads. Now, the funny thing is now in original series, we never saw any Hemkuch until we get to the motion picture.
They've always said the reason for that is that they took the Kuch-Ha and used them to deal with the Federation because the Klingon High Council didn't think that the Federation was worth dealing with the Kuch-Ha Klingons. Which brings me to the point in the book where, because you see this racial distinction between the two, you get to see the societies of the Klingon Empire kind of having a riff and racial prejudice, shall we say.
Yes, there is definitely that. And even though it has nothing to do with the actual genetic makeup of Klingons, it was all an accident perpetrated by this virus that they tried to create the augments with. You get this bigotry rise between the smooth-headed Klingons and the ridged-headed Klingons.
Which brings us back to the albino's origin, in that his mother had been using prosthetics to hide the fact that she had a smooth forehead with ridged prosthetics, and she was having Drs. Negg and Drs. Holmgren working to genetically change her son, who is still in the womb, to give him real ridges for his forehead. But their experiment went awry, and while Keg had ridges when he was born, he was born an albino. He was born weak and sickly. He was born something that Klingon culture required his mother to terminate.
Right. And then after he was saved, he had to constantly look for things to keep him alive, different variations on different kinds of diseases just to keep himself alive, which, of course, quit working and just almost made things worse. He was just on a constant hunt for new compounds to just keep himself alive.
And being a scientist, I would have liked more of an explanation of why that was the case. I mean, he's found something, it's done the job, why does it not work? But then again, that would have bogged down the story. This story was a good length for a story, and the way they told it kept it moving.
Yeah. Well, there was that missing, you know, I mean, as a child, as a baby, how did he survive without all of this to begin with, you know? And as you said earlier, where did he get the education to learn the science that he learned to keep going where he was? I think there could have been maybe just some mention of it at some point.
Something anyway. Gene manipulation is not easy.
No, not by any stretch. But at any rate, it didn't detract from the story. It's just something that a person would wonder about as they read the book.
Now, a little earlier, I threw out a couple of doctors' names, a couple of Klingon doctors. They're important to the story, too, because eventually, I believe it's Dr. Negg that is going to end up working solely with the albino, and Dr. Holmgren, who is working to try and bring honor back to his family name because his great-grandfather or one of his ancestors is the Dr. Antioch, who caused the smooth forehead perturbation in the Klingon genome.
Yeah, as we saw in Enterprise, Dr. Antioch, he was, you know, trying to create a super Klingon, and the mistakes that that created the human augments that just about destroyed our race were being the same mistakes that Dr. Antioch was making on Enterprise, trying to make enhanced Klingons. You know, it just seems like history repeats itself all the time.
But in this case, Dr. Herkholm, the descendant, was trying to do it to restore the honor back to his ancestor's name.
What do you think, he succeeded at that, or did he fail?
He would have succeeded, except for what happened to him after he succeeded. He was killed before he could tell anybody he did it.
You know, and the funny thing of this is now, I don't know if it's funny or not, but another aspect of this is the Trill changes in between Next Generation and Deep Space Nine are explained. It's much the same thing. When we first see the Trill, they have the ridged facial features, and then when we get to Deep Space Nine, Jadzia is without that. The only thing that distinguishes her from being human would be the spots. And it's the same idea with the smooth forehead and rigid forehead Klingons that the enhancement virus affects a lot of other people too.
Yeah, I think that's what's important about this novel, in that it does bridge a lot of these gaps that are there that we kind of overlook, but nag at us, and now we've got some kind of an explanation.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember what the Trill's name was on Next Generation. Do you remember that? I can't remember.
No, I don't.
I was thinking about it this morning, and I had the name, and now I can't remember. Of course, when I need to remember, I don't. Well, the one thing that was unfamiliar, that wasn't part of the story in Deep Space Nine, was Sulu's involvement here. And we find out that Sulu encountered the albino at a very young age, and he almost lost his life. And as a consequence of that and being able to escape, Sulu's parents almost were killed at the same time.
To an extent that when Sulu points this out to the albino decides to put a family curse on Sulu.
Yes. And we get included because of that. We also get Demora, Sulu's daughter, who there was an attempt on her life.
It allows the authors to bring in the Enterprise B and I believe Chekhov.
Chekhov was mentioned. Okay. Apparently he was serving on board the Enterprise. John Harriman went on to continue to be captain of the Enterprise B. Chekhov is on his ship, and then Sulu, if I recall correctly, was considering calling Chekhov in to be his first officer but decided to stay with the current first officer that was with him.
Well, what I got was that the Enterprise B, when he called up the Enterprise B, it was just prior to the launch of the Enterprise B that we see in Star Trek. I'm drawing a blank now. The continuation thing. Generations. Star Trek Generation.
Oh, really? See, now you might have picked up on that. I missed that it hadn't been launched yet. Now that's interesting.
Scotty was there and they were waiting for Kirk to show up.
Yeah. Okay.
So yeah, there's another thread that the authors bring in to this mosaic of a novel that they've gotten. I've never seen a tighter weave of a novel, Star Trek novel anyway, than this particular book.
It really is good. It brings explains so many unexplained things from the series that there just wasn't time to learn about. And you know, I could see this being canon, but of course, as we know, the novels are not canon.
No, but another thing I want to bring up is, do you remember all of the antique weapons that Sulu had on his wall?
You mean in the book?
No, I mean in the Enterprise, in his quarters.
I'm trying to recall, but I don't.
I know Kirk had a bunch of antique weapons, but they become important in this novel because phasers and disruptors can't work in a couple of energy fields that get established, but chemically propelled pieces of lead do.
Yeah, that was cool. I remember. I know that happened. He they talked about he had a large collection of weapons in his quarters, and he even had ammunition for them. And yep, he used a slug thrower to help himself out there once.
And to give you an idea what the albino is like, they surprise the albino's men with these weapons. And the very next encounter they have with the albino, he's got chemically propelled pieces of lead to shoot back at them.
Yeah, where did he get those?
The authors penciled them in.
So there was nothing.
There was nothing said as to how he replicated them or anything, because if he was going to replicate them, he would have had to know how they were made and the principles on which they operate before he could tell the computer, oh, I need this, 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 and this. Oh, and don't forget the bullet.
Yeah. You mean he couldn't just go to the replicator and say, give me a Smith & Wesson Model 15.
Well, it might happen if it was a Earth-based replicator and not a Klingon-based replicator or an Orion-based replicator.
Yeah. Well, the funny thing is now, if somebody was going to replicate something, I would think they'd probably replicate something a little more lethal. You know, okay, well, the other side has Colt 45, so I want a minigun.
Or in the case of the albino, okay, they've got guns. Replicate me knockout gas and a few respirators.
Yeah, there you go.
But the fact that they were thought about and used in the story worked.
Yes. Oh, yeah. So let's talk a little bit about CAG's people. He seemed to have quite a diverse group of people with him. He had Orions, and he had Klingons too. And what else did he have with him?
I don't remember. They were kind of minor. But what was really important is the crew that picked him up was captained by an Orion female who was controlling everybody on the ship for CAG with her pheromones. Her number one officer was another Orion, male, but he wanted CAG to come up, the albino to come up with something, her pheromones, so he could take over the ship, which, of course, the albino does, and he takes over the ship, but the albino did something to him, and he dies also, and the albino gets control of the ship.
Well, yeah, which would...
Better living through drugs.
Yeah, which would only make sense. Better living through chemistry. So let's talk about some of the themes that we have running through this book. You've identified three. First one was trust and power.
We've got the whole concept of honor that the Klingons are looking for and how they cannot trust another individual unless that individual places honor above all, or at least towards the top, and works towards maintaining their own personal honor. We have the power concept in that while the albino doesn't really give a hoot about the old Klingon principles, aka honor, he believes in finding ways of controlling people through microbiology, in that everybody who works for him is infected with a virus that if they don't live up to what the albino wants them to do, he won't give them the antidote when it's due.
Now that was interesting. It's interesting you bring that up, because that's the issue that happened with Demora. There was the assassin that Kag sent after her, and he had to inject her with the virus that was supposed to kill her. And he was reluctant to do it because, first of all, he was afraid he was going to get caught. And secondly, he didn't want to. He just simply didn't want to. But he knew he had to, because if he failed, he would not be able to get the chemical or whatever it was that would keep him alive from Kag. Kag would just simply withhold what was keeping him alive.
Now, he was a professional assassin. So when you say he was afraid to do the deed, it's because he would have to do the deed in a bar with Demora, surrounded by other Federation officers. He actually had to catch her on her way to the bathroom.
Yeah. And even then, he made it look like an accident. But even as a professional assassin, the only pay he's going to get for this is that he's going to be allowed to live and continue to have to be subservient to Kag.
Except that as soon as he got back and made his report, he gets killed.
Yeah, Kag kills him anyway.
Because apparently he was skimming profits of some sort off the top, and the albino couldn't.
Yeah, I don't know if he was or wasn't skimming profits actually, but that's what he was told the reason was, you know, or it could have been just to simply cover up the trail.
It's in the last part of the novel, so I'm figuring it's the authors needed some reason for the albino to off him once he gets done with his mission.
Yeah. So, and then as far as trust and power and honor is concerned, perhaps I'm wrong, I don't know, but my impression of Klingon honor is that Klingons care a great deal about being honorable in the eyes of other Klingons. But as far as being honorable in the eyes of humans, Vulcans, Andorians, Romulans, or whatever, they don't give a hoot, because, you know, those are enemies. Those are people to be eliminated. But when you're dealing Klingon to Klingon, it has to be honorable.
I take it another step, though, Jim. Klingons feel they have to be honorable to themselves. They have to be honorable to the Klingon society. They honor above all else. But when it comes to alien races, they still have to be honorable. But the alien races do not understand how the Klingon warrior is being honorable in any given situation.
Yeah, okay. That's an excellent explanation.
Well, if we're going to turn you into a preacher for Kalis, you need to think of these things.
Yeah, I should probably think about it. So you have something else in the notes that strikes a chord with me, and I'd like to hear your take on it. It says that you had a problem with three Dahar masters being suckered over and over by the albino.
Yeah. These guys are supposed to be really, really savvy in the ways of war. And the albino just keeps getting the upper hand on them each and every time.
Well, do you think maybe that's because Kor, Koloth, and Kang are fighting as honorable warriors? Now we're getting back to the honor theme. They are fighting as honorable warriors, and this albino is anything but honorable.
Well, in the albino using disguised explosives or microbiology to do his dirty work, so to speak, yeah, that's on the dishonorable side. But the fact that he's able to pull his vessel up between all of the ships and start picking them off, no, that's a pretty honorable task. He has to decloak. It's not like the bird of prey from Star Trek VI where you could fire cloaked. He has to decloak and fire and move on to the next target. He has a chance to be shot at. It's just apparently they're not quick enough or something.
Yeah. The thing though, that I think is he's honorable in one way, but he's not honorable in other ways. So then we're talking about degrees of honor. My thought would be is if he dishonors himself in one way where he kills others, but he breaks the rule of facing your enemy, then he's just plain dishonorable all the way across. No matter what his tactics are, he is not an honorable Klingon.
The albino is not trained in the ways of honor that all other Klingons were. He does not accept that as a necessity for his life. So he pulls all of these things, which to him are not necessarily honorable because he doesn't have the concept of honor, but are practical and are what he knows how to do. So to him, they're the way you do things.
Okay, I can accept that, but he's still dishonorable because he is a Klingon and he behaves dishonorably by Klingon standards, regardless of whether he understands it or not. Because would you say that ignorance of honor would excuse him from being that way if he were to move to Kronos?
Does ignorance excuse the Federation?
Ignorance of Klingon
honor?
Tricky
point, isn't it?
Well, it is.
That's a tricky point, isn't it? Because you can think of the albino as a non-Klingon from the point of view he hasn't been trained in the Klingon rites, the way the Federation hasn't been trained in the Klingon rites, except for Curzon Dax, who has the training, does what he needs to do, and becomes honorable in the eyes of three Dahar masters, or should I say three future Dahar masters.
Yeah, they actually see him as a warrior, and by extension, they see Jadzia as one also.
Even though they try to excuse her from the blood oath because she's not the same person as Curzon Dax.
Yeah. And you know, in Deep Space Nine, just kind of as an aside, that little thread comes up every now and then too, whether Jadzia can be held responsible for the past hosts because through her symbiont because of that, or if Jadzia would be innocent of anything the previous hosts would have done.
I just got done rewatching an episode called Dax, first season. It's like the sixth episode where they go into those issues.
Isn't that the one where she is put on trial and it turns out that Curzon wasn't responsible because because he was having an affair with the lady? I can't remember.
The wife of the person they have killed. Yeah, that's the one.
Okay. Yeah. Well, and it comes up a few times in there.
Once you've got a good idea that you can keep plumbing for more and more philosophical ideas to look at it, you don't let it go.
No. And this book is chock-a-block full of them. We could discuss philosophical issues in this book a lot because there are a lot of those, as you've just pointed out.
But here's an interesting thing for you. How good are the Excelsior's sensors that they could pick up the trail of the albino light years, many light years from where the Excelsior has to sit, ordered by the Federation to sit and not pursue them? And, well, let's face it, the Excelsior is showing weakness and dishonor to the Klingons, and they keep commenting about it. Dave Sulu can't do much about it. But how good are those sensors? They can keep picking up his trail.
Yeah. But how inept are they also when they can't detect a cloaked ship? They can't detect the explosive that killed their captain on the planet. If their sensors were that good, then none of this would have happened.
Yeah, sometimes you got to have a blind spot or the story doesn't go anywhere.
Yeah, well, and that's suspension of disbelief. I mean, you could probably find, if you go looking for them, I don't care what it is, you can find plot holes everywhere. But it, you know, I'm not looking for that. I don't look to pick things apart. I look for entertainment value instead. And if I have to suspend disbelief a little bit, I don't mind doing that, especially if I get some enjoyment out of it.
Hey, one of the big things we have to do with Star Trek and the Star Trek universe is pick their plot holes to death.
Nah, life's too short for that. Just kick back and enjoy it for what it is. Good entertainment.
And I think that pretty much sums it up for this book. This book is very entertaining. And personally, I would highly recommend it to anybody who would like a good read. It's supposed to be the first of a series. The series never got written, but this book is good.
I agree. It is. It moves along. It doesn't slow down very much at all. It just keeps going and brings in more and more things. If you're a Star Trek fan, you'll enjoy it because it fills things in. If you are just a beginning to enjoy Star Trek with very little knowledge, you could really enjoy this as something to start with.
And if you're just beginning to watch Star Trek and read this book, it's going to encourage you to watch more and more of the episodes because it's got things from the original series, the animated series, and DS9 all thrown into this web.
Not to mention the movies.
I was lumping them in with the original series.
Ah, there we go. So, John, do we have something we're going to look at next? Do you have something in mind?
We haven't looked at the Day of Honor series, if you want to start looking at those.
Okay, Day of Honor series. Let's go ahead and call that good for what's coming up next.
This particular series of four books, each book takes a different series to where you get to the final book, which is actually an original series story, but it is the story of why the Day of Honor became a holiday in the Klingon culture.
All right. Sounds great. So the Day of Honor series is where we are going. Outstanding. We'll be looking at that. Take a look in the show notes and we'll show you how to get in touch with us. If you want to leave comments, we're always happy to hear from our listeners. And join us next time on Bound by Honor. I am Jajim.
I am Jorn.
Kapla. You have been listening to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Assault Group Book Review Podcast. Bound by Honor is brought to you by the Klingon Assault Group and is produced by Admiral Kirk Zantai Loon Keej. If you hear the call of the warrior, visit our homepage at www.kag.org to learn more about what it means to be Klingon. Perhaps you have what it takes to be one of us. Listener feedback is always welcome at podcast@kag.org. Kaplop!